Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. Now, today we are jumping straight into a massive global health challenge. I mean, we're talking about a disease that really shaped human history.
Yeah, and it's still driving huge outbreaks today.
Right, cholera. It causes, I think, around 2.8 million cases and like up to 90,000 fatalities globally every single year.
It is a massive burden, but there is a huge plot twist at the heart of this pathogen's biology.
Okay, I love a good plot twist. Lay it on me.
So the bacterium we associate with the disease, Vibrio cholerae, is actually ubiquitous in marine environments.
Like just out in the ocean.
Exactly, yeah, just out in estuaries. And a lot of those environmental strains are completely harmless to humans.
Wait, really? Harmless?
Yeah, they're just free-living microbes swimming around. They only become a deadly human pathogen when they basically undergo a hostile corporate takeover by a virus.
Okay, wait, so the bacteria is essentially innocent until it catches a virus of its own?
Essentially, yes. The primary culprit here is a filamentous phage called CTXV.
CTXV. Got it.
Right. So this viral hijacker infects the bacterium, and then it actually integrates its own genetic material directly into the host's chromosome.
Oh, wow. So it just physically inserts itself in there.
Exactly. And it forces the bacterial machinery to read a very specific set of viral instructions. These are the CTXV genes.
And those are the genes that actually encode the cholera toxin, right?
You got it. The microbe is transformed into a weapons factory against its will.
That is wild. And I guess that sets up the central tension for our deep dive today.
It really does, because you have to think about the logistics of that.
Right, like if you have a microbe carrying around a lethal virus, how does the bacterium survive the manufacturing process?
Exactly. What really happens when a bacterial cell has to babysit a massive viral replication factory, all while trying to successfully establish an infection in a human host?
Today, we celebrate the work of the researchers at Friedrich Schiller University in Germany and the University of Birmingham in the UK, who have advanced our understanding of how bacteria regulate the viral genes that make them pathogenic.
And it's such an elegant mechanism they discovered.
Okay, let's unpack this, because to appreciate the scale of their discovery, we really have to look at the blind spot in the existing literature.
Yeah, we've known for decades about the integration of the CTXV phage.
Right, we understand the transcriptional control, you know, how environmental signals trigger the DNA to start printing those viral RNA transcripts.
But the blind spot is what happens after the RNA is printed. We are looking at post-transcriptional regulation.
Meaning, once the viral mRNA is just, you know, floating around the cytoplasm, how does the host cell actually keep it in check?
Right, because managing that viral RNA is a life or death logistical nightmare for the bacterium.
I can imagine. But before we get too deep into that, can you clarify something about the life cycle of the phage? Because most people, you know, when they think of viruses, they think of them just exploding out of the cells.
Oh, right, lysing the cell. Yeah, no, this phage is different. We have to remember the physical nature of CTXV. It is a filamentous phage.
Filamentous, so it's shaped like a long thread.
Exactly, and its life cycle relies on continuous secretion. It doesn't just accumulate inside the cell until the pressure causes the bacterium to rupture.
So it doesn't pop the cell like a balloon.
No, it continuously extrudes itself through the bacterial envelope.
Oh, weird. So it's constantly pushing its way out.
Yeah, leaving the host cell structurally intact so it can just keep producing more and more viruses.
Okay, but if the virus is constantly assembling and pushing its way out, it must be hijacking the cell's physical infrastructure, right? Like, the phage filaments can't just magically phase through a double membrane.
Right, they have to use a dedicated exit door. And they hijack a massive multi-protein complex called the type 2 secretion system, or T2SS.
T2SS, okay.
Yeah. This is a highly specialized channel that actually spans both the inner and outer membranes of the bacterium.
So the virus relies entirely on the host's T2SS to thread its newly assembled filaments out into the environment.
Exactly. Which introduces a glaring bottleneck.
Right, because Vibrio cholerae built that secretion system for its own use. It needs those specific exit channels to export its own molecules.
Most notably, the cholera toxin itself.
Ah, so if the phage is constantly printing its own structural proteins and aggressively pumping viral filaments through those exact same channels,
it's going to cause a massive traffic jam.
Yeah, that makes sense. The bacterium needs a way to throttle the viral factory, or it will literally choke on its own virulence factors.
Exactly. And finding that microscopic brake pedal requires capturing the bacteria in the act of fighting back.
Which I imagine isn't easy.
No, it's really hard. You can't just observe this defensive mechanism when Vibrio cholerae is lounging in a standard nutrient-rich laboratory broth.
Because under those comfortable conditions, the phage is mostly dormant, right?
Exactly. The researchers had to simulate the extreme stress of the human gastrointestinal tract.
And to do that, they used AKI media.
Yes, AKI media. It's this highly specific chemical cocktail.
It has sodium bicarbonate, bile salts, and microaerobic conditions, right?
Right. It's basically designed to trick the bacterium into thinking it just bypassed the stomach acid and landed directly in the human intestine.
And in AKI media, the bacterium panics and activates its full virulence cascade.
That's right. And once the virulence pathways were firing, the research team deployed a technique called RIL-Seq.
RIL-Seq. Let me see. That stands for RNA Interaction by Ligation and Sequencing.
You got it. And the technology really hinges on isolating a specific bacterial chaperone protein called HFQ.
HFQ, and what does HFQ actually do?
Well, it forms this ring-shaped hexamer that acts as a scaffold. Its primary function is to grab tiny, non-coding regulatory RNAs and help them physically base pair with much larger target messenger RNAs.
Okay, but I'm stuck on one thing here.
What's that?
Well, RNA molecules are notoriously fragile, right? And inside a living bacterial cell, these molecules are moving at lightning speed.
Oh, absolutely. The interactions mediated by HFQ are highly transient. They happen in a flash.
So how can the researchers possibly freeze the cell fast enough to see which specific RNAs are binding to each other at any given millisecond?
Ah, that is the clever part. They solved that kinetic problem using in vivo UV cross-linking.
UV cross-linking, like with ultraviolet light.
Yeah. Before they even break open the cells, they hit the living bacterial culture with a massive dose of UV light.
Whoa, okay.
The UV photons excite the pyrimidine bases in the RNA, causing them to form covalent bonds with the nearby amino acids of the HFQ protein.
So it essentially spot welds the interacting RNA molecules to the chaperone complex at the exact moment they are base pairing.
Spot welds is the perfect way to describe it, yes.
Here's where it gets really interesting. It's like walking into a crowded, chaotic dance floor. The music is blasting. Thousands of RNA molecules are bumping into each other, exchanging partners.
I love this analogy.
Right, and you can't just sit on the sidelines and take notes because the turnover's too fast.
Way too fast.
So you hit the room with that UV light, which acts as instant superglue. It permanently freezes the HFQ protein and its two RNA partners into a single physical complex right there on the dance floor.
That visual captures the methodology perfectly.
So what happens after they superglue everyone together?
Well, once the complexes are welded together, the researchers lyse the cells, they extract those HFQ RNA clusters, and they use an enzyme called an RNA lyse to physically stitch the ends of the interacting RNAs together.
Stitching them into a single continuous molecule.
Exactly. And then they run that chimeric molecule through high-throughput sequencing.
Which gives them a comprehensive map of every single RNA-RNA interaction that was happening during the peak of the party.
Right, during the peak of virulence.
So when they looked at the sequencing data from that super glue dance floor, who was the star dancer?
What's fascinating here is that one specific interaction completely dominated the landscape.
Really? Just one?
Pretty much. The star dancer under virulence conditions was a previously uncharacterized small regulatory RNA.
And the researchers named it CISR. Right, which stands for CTXY inhibiting small RNA.
Exactly. Under comfortable conditions, CISR was barely detectable.
But in the stressful AKI media.
In the AKI media, CISR went into absolute overdrive. A staggering 80% of its interactions were directed at one single target.
80%. That is a massive preference.
It's huge. And that target was the viral CEP mRNA.
Okay, and what is CEP? Like CEP CEP?
Yes, CEP. The CEP transcript is basically the blueprint for the major coat protein of the phage.
The coat protein. So to assemble just one individual viral particle, the phage requires thousands upon thousands of copies of the CEP protein to form that protective outer sheath.
Right. It is the most highly demanded structural component during viral replication.
And the researchers proved that the CISR small RNA physically base pairs directly over the ribosome binding site of the CEP mRNA.
Exactly. So the viral blueprint is just floating there in the cytoplasm, but CISR physically sits right on the ignition switch,
preventing the bacterial ribosome from clamping down and translating the RNA into protein.
Yes, it's literally a molecular boot on the tire of the viral factory.
Man, that is so cool. And I guess the efficiency of that blockade really becomes obvious when you remove it, right?
Oh, completely. The team actually engineered a mutant strain of Vibrio cholerae, lacking the Caesar RNA entirely, to see what would happen.
And then what? Do they stress them out again?
Oh, yeah. They challenged the cells with mitomycin C, or MMC, which is a DNA damaging agent.
Oh, right. And that triggers the bacterial SOS response.
Exactly. And the SOS response normally cleaves a repressor protein called Lexa. That cleavage acts as the ultimate signal for the dormant phage to wake up.
Like a signal to start replicating furiously before the host cell dies.
Right. So you hit the bacteria with MMC, sending a massive wake-up call to the virus.
But the bacteria no longer has its Caesar brake pedal to manage the surge.
Exactly. And the outcome was explosive.
Explosive how? Like, how much more coat protein did it make?
The translation of the viral coat protein skyrocketed over 100-fold compared to the wild-type strain.
100-fold? That is insane.
Without Caesar holding the line, the virus just monopolized the host's translation machinery,
leading to a massive overproduction of infectious phage particles.
Exactly. And this raises an important question. What is the evolutionary origin of this highly specific defensive weapon?
Yeah, if Caesar is suppressing an externally acquired viral gene, where does the instruction manual for Caesar itself actually live within the bacterial genome?
And the genomic mapping of Caesar is arguably the most elegant detail of this entire study.
Because Caesar is not just some standalone gene with its own dedicated promoter, right?
No, it doesn't just sit neatly on the chromosome waiting to be transcribed. It is essentially a molecular coupon cut out of a receipt.
A coupon cut out of a receipt. I love that. So the sequence for Caesar is basically embedded at the very tail end, the 3' untranslated region.
Exactly, the 3' UTR.
Of an entirely different, highly conserved bacterial gene called PRTV.
Yes, PRTV, which encodes a secreted protease.
And a protease is an enzyme that breaks down proteins, right? So the bacterium relies on it to modify its external environment.
Right, to degrade host defense proteins and manage biofilm formation in the human gut.
So when the RNA polymerase transcribes the DNA to make the PRTV messenger RNA, it reads all the way through the coding sequence and generates a long transcript with an extended tail.
Exactly. And rather than letting that extended tail go to waste,
a bacterial enzyme called RNase E comes along.
Yep.
And this acts like a pair of molecular scissors, right?
Yes, RNase E cleanly snips the 3' tail off the PRTA transcript.
And that standalone, snipped-off fragment folds into a stable structure and just becomes the independent Caesar regulatory RNA.
It is brilliant. The bacteria generates its viral handbrake as a direct byproduct of manufacturing an enzyme it already needs for survival.
That is wild. It's like, I don't know, building a car and using the leftover scrap metal to build the brake pads.
Exactly. And the regulatory network controlling that process is exquisitely sensitive to the environment.
Right, because the transcription of the PRTV gene, and therefore the production of Caesar, relies on two master transcription factors turning simultaneously.
HAPR and CRP.
HAPR and CRP, let's break those down. HAPR is the central regulator for quorum sensing, correct?
Right, so HAPR accumulates when the bacterial population reaches a high cell density.
So it essentially tells the individual cell, hey, we have successfully colonized the gut. We are surrounded by our neighbors.
Precisely. And CRP, on the other hand, monitors the energy state of the cell.
Right. It responds to cyclic AMP levels, which spike when the bacteria is starved of its preferred carbon sources, like glucose.
So CRP is basically signaling we are running out of easy energy. We are starving.
And the promoter region for the pre-free V gene requires both of those transcription factors to bind cooperatively to launch this defense.
Exactly. The bacteria must be experiencing both high crowding and severe starvation,
which are the exact conditions of peak infection in a competitive human gut.
Right. And that triggers the mass production of the Caesar viral brake pedal.
So what does this all mean? We have a bacterium sensing extreme environmental stress, which triggers it to produce a protease for survival. And the waste product of that RNA is repurposed to shut down the viral coat protein.
Exactly. And to understand why that matters, we have to look at the broader physiological impact.
Right. We mentioned the type 2 secretion system earlier, that highly restrictive exit channel spanning the bacterial membranes.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the sheer mechanics of the T2SS dictate the necessity of Caesar.
because the secretion system uses a piston-like mechanism composed of pseudopilins to push fully folded proteins out of the cell, right?
Right. It's a slow, energy-intensive process with limited bandwidth.
And during peak virulence, the bacterium desperately needs those channels cleared to export the cholera toxin itself.
Exactly. The toxin is a complex heterohexamer. It requires significant space and time to be secreted properly.
But at the exact same moment, the virus is trying to use those identical channels to extrude its newly assembled filaments.
Yes. And if the virus is left unchecked, its massive demand for the sepcoat protein overwhelms the secretion machinery.
The exit channels become physically jammed with viral components.
And the cholera toxin backs up in the periplasm, the bacterium suffers immense envelope stress, and its ability to maintain the infection basically collapses.
So the bacteria uses SysR to throttle the virus so it doesn't choke on its own virulence factors. The RNA acts as a sophisticated traffic controller.
It throttles the viral output just enough to keep the critical secretion lanes open for the bacterium's own toxins.
That is incredible.
It perfectly illustrates an evolutionary arms race that has settled into a delicate negotiated truce.
Because the sep gene is an exogenous invader.
All right.
It was horizontally acquired from a phage that wanted to exploit the host.
Right. But the cisRNA is a core part of the bacterial genome. It originally evolved to regulate its own host genes, like PRTV.
And somewhere along the evolutionary timeline, after the CTX5 phage integrated into the Vibrio cholerae genome, the bacterium adapted its pre-existing machinery to recognize and suppress the invading sequence.
Exactly. It co-opted its own waste product to keep the invading phage on a leash. It domesticated the virus, allowing it to replicate at a low, manageable simmer rather than a lethal boil.
You know, I want to push the implications of that domestication a bit further.
Okay.
Because whenever we identify a critical regulatory bottleneck in a major human pathogen, it kind of opens the door for novel therapeutics, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
We are currently facing a massive global crisis with antibiotic resistance, mainly because traditional antibiotics apply brute force selective pressure.
Right, they kill the bacteria, which forces it to mutate and evolve resistance.
So what if we don't try to kill Vibrio cholerae? What if we just cut its brake lines?
Oh, I see where you're going. You are suggesting a therapeutic intervention that intentionally antagonizes the SysR small RNA.
Exactly. If SysR is the handbrake, preventing a fatal traffic jam in the bacteria, could future therapeutics intentionally block SysR?
That is a fascinating idea.
Right. Because if you strip away that protection, the viral sep expression would skyrocket.
The phage would overproduce its coat proteins.
Violently hijack the T2SS and completely clog the exit channels.
Which means the lethal cholera toxin would be trapped inside the periplasm of the bacterium where it can't interact with the human intestinal lining.
Exactly. We neutralize the toxicity of the infection by turning the pathogen's own viral passenger into a fatal liability.
It is a phenomenal conceptual leap. By mapping these hidden non-coding RNA networks, we uncover vulnerabilities that don't exist on the traditional antibiotic spectrum.
Yeah, we stop looking at the bacterial cell as a static target.
And start treating it as a highly volatile ecosystem. When you understand the delicate negotiations happening between the host chromosome and the integrated viral elements, you can disrupt the balance and let the pathogen's own internal conflicts destroy its ability to cause disease.
It fundamentally changes our perspective on host-pathogen interactions. So, to pull all these complex threads together, Vibrio cholerae, the bacterium responsible for devastating global outbreaks, relies on a highly specific small RNA called SysR to survive the dangerous virus living inside it.
Right.
And by literally splicing this regulatory RNA from the tail end of a completely different survival gene, the bacterium links its own signals for starvation and crowding to an emergency handbrake on viral replication,
which prevents the virus from overproducing its coat proteins and jamming the cellular exit doors,
ensuring the bacterium can still secrete the toxins necessary to sustain the infection.
The elegance of the system really lies in its resourcefulness. The bacterium uses a byproduct of its normal transcription to maintain a functional, if tense, coexistence with a lethal parasite.
It is biological engineering at its absolute finest. And it leaves us with a lingering thought for you, our listener.
Mm-hmm.
What does this mean for our understanding of how our own human cells might be using hidden, tiny pieces of RNA to domesticate the ancient viruses lurking deep within our own DNA?
Now that is something to think about.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
Screen midnight, a whisper splits from the tail. A small cut message from the afterword, riding a ribbon nucleus trail. It finds a waiting chaperone, it learns a lock and key, and hovers near the start of fire, where proteins want to be. When the crowd gets louder, when the carbon signs turn bright, two sentries lift a signal up to keep the timing right. A hidden line becomes a lever, gentle but precise, and stops the spark from catching fast with one clean slice of ice. Sis on the switch, on the edge of the stars, hands on the ribosome door, keeping toxins apart. Hold the coat, slow the tide, let the storm lose its grip. One small RNA can change the whole trip. A filament wants a highway, a coat wants to rise, but base paired in the doorway, the invitation dies. Less set than the darkened lane, fewer threads released, and what could spread like wildfire turns to embers, then to peace. Not a siren, more a checkpoint where the busy signals meet. Quorum voices in the airwaves, hunger tapping out a beat. Between the cell and what escapes, a quiet rule is drawn. Translate a little slower now and see the danger gone. Sis on the switch, on the edge of the start, hands on the ribosome door, keeping toxins apart. Hold the coat, slow the tide, let the storm lose its grip. One small RNA can change.